Hi, I'm Michael Silverblatt. Thanks for tuning in to Bookworm. Some of our most exciting storytellers share their work orally, and that's the kind of work you can hear on KCRW's Unfictional. Intimate stories, cleverly made documentaries, produced all around the world by some of the most talented radio producers we have. Check out Unfictional. You can find it on KCRW's iTunes page.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm very, very happy I get to talk to and see Thomas McGuane for the first time in many years. His book, A Book of Short Stories, is Crowfare. It's published by Knopf. Several of the stories were read by me in The New Yorker as they came out, and it's a pleasure to read them again, along with 10 others, a nice-sized collection of new stories by Thomas McGuane. Now, once upon a time, when his first book, The Sporting Club, came out, he was sort of compared to F. Scott Fitzgerald and a generation of, gentlemen and gentlewomen who were losing their purchase on American life. The Bushwhack Piano saw that loosen up still more, and then things became so hectic in the high 60s and early 70s that one anticipated a McGuane novel with a species of excitement and dread. Then close thine eyes with holy dread, for he on honeydew has fed and drunk the milk of paradise. Now he's settled down enough that the rugged craziness of the stories has sort of taken a back seat, and these stories really follow the rules of short stories while using the weaponry of McGuane language. Short, sharp shocks and a lot of satire about the American way of anti-living. I wondered, what is a short story for you at this point? What does it have to do?
A short story has to have a pretty good power to weight ratio as compared to what we might find in the novel, which was Randall Jarrell defined as a document of a certain length with something wrong with it. And short stories are kind of intolerant about that, and in some ways they're very much harder to write. You know, I came to short stories with all the momentum of the kind of fiction I had been writing already, but I had a tremendous respect for relatively traditional short stories, Frank O'Connor and John Cheever and V.S. Pritchett, a million others. And
there's some Chekhov in here, too.
Oh, there's a lot of I've read everything of Chekhov more than once, because Chekhov can only do you good. I mean, he's so free of falsehood that the only thing you learn from him is to go from one perception to another and stop dribbling. I've been trying to sell my NBA shot clock theory to my fellow novelists.
What's that?
Well, that when you start a paragraph, we start the shot clock. And at some point or another, you have to get somewhere, or the buzzer goes off. It's like the gong show. And a lot of novelists, especially fashionable younger novelists now, would fail that test because they seem to think that infinite rambling is okay. Well, anyway, that won't work in the short story. Short story has to get somewhere. I don't mean to say that it has to. It can't be the kind of non sequitur it once was, and actually in the earlier days of New Yorker fiction. But it has to be about its business pretty directly and get there.
Okay, well, let's set the timer. Here is a story called The House on Sand Creek, and I think it gets to business pretty directly.
Okay.
From the collection Crow Fair. It's Thomas McGuain.
This is the opening of The House on Sand Creek. When Monica and I were first married and rented a house on Sand Creek, sight unseen, because Monica wanted to live in the country, and nothing else was available within reach of town. Everything we had been told was true. The house was a furnished ranch house with two bedrooms, two baths, near a quiet grove of aspens. It had been repossessed from a cowboy and his wife who had gone to Nevada or Oregon, somewhere in the Great Basin. The man at the bank said that he was an old-time rambling buckaroo who stopped making his mortgage payments because, quote, he was looking for a quit, unquote. Monica turned to me for an explanation, but I just wanted to get the deal done and move in. It might not be exactly to your taste, the banker said, but nothing says you can't tweak it. It was an absolute horror. Skinned coyote carcasses were piled on the front step, and a dead horse hung from its halter where it had been tied to the porch. Inside was a shambles, and there was one detail we couldn't understand without the help of the neighbors. Shotgun blasts through the bathroom door. Apparently, Mrs. Old-Time Buckaroo used to chase Mr. Old-Time Buckaroo around the house until he ran into the bathroom, locked the door, and hid in the bath. The sides of the tub were pocked with lead. Monica, who had seen the dead horse, said that it was a shame the wife had failed and that the two of them were now in the Great Basin living out their lives. This is a bit of an understatement. At the time, Monica broke into sobs and begged to be taken away. "Is this how you treat your wife?" she turned on me. "Stop calling me your princess, you bastard." I never quite got used to these flare-ups or to Monica's sometimes misleading passion for fresh starts. Monica was not only not a Westerner, she was not even an American. She had been stranded in architecture school by the uproar in the former Yugoslavia, and by the time it was safe for her to go home, we had met and planned to marry, which we did, and now we were in that house. Monica was commuting to architecture school, and I was running an underemployed law office that 5 years earlier had done 30 real estate closings a month, and now did at most two, and often none. Booms in real estate came and went like weather, except that there always seemed to be plenty of weather. I am aware that my ability to wittily point out things like this and to describe the house the way I am describing it has a lot to do with the fact that Monica left soon after we moved in. She abandoned what she contemptuously described as, quote, the Western lifestyle, to return to her parents in Bosnia-Herzegovina. There she found herself a nice house with no dead horses or coyotes, and a nice man and a nice baby, a twofer in the fresh start business. Ours had been a poor excuse for a marriage, born on an ill wind from the start. I was still in the house, which we had painted in such a hurry that we'd rolled right over the outlets and floor moldings in uneven lines, giving one the feeling that the interior had somehow been draped in paint. For a long time, the sight of the walls kept Monica in my mind, even when women folk came for a visit, always short. Something, either me or the house, seemed to give them the willies.
Tom McGuain, reading the first couple of pages from the second short story in the book Crow Fair, and that short story, The House on Sand Creek. Now, got an epigraph here from the great Russian poet Marina Tsvetaeva. The rest of you can eat me up, I just record your behavior. And I guess the first time I noticed the Russian influence, there was a Russian epigraph to your, what, third novel, 92 in the Shade. Man is excellently made and eagerly lives the kind of life that is being lived. Mikhail Zoshenko. That sense that life, however it's lived, is the wrong life, is the wrong way of living,
right,
accounts for a good deal of your ability to capture life on the page. She was stranded in architecture school. Mm-hmm. Seems like something that happened not just to a Croat here or there, but to a whole generation.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah.
It's a new kind of lost generation, feeling that you're sort of askew from what actually should be going on.
And that the writer of the story needs to find the phrases to rapidly anatomize these phenomena, that they're not worth dwelling on. It's like a little summary or picture book, photo album of an age and its foibles. This is the way we live now. This is the way life is being lived. It's ridiculous, but we can't spend too much time on it. Who isn't ridiculous?
Yeah. Well, I hope you're right about that. I mean, that's very close to what I wish I was doing.
It makes me happy. I'm also wondering, there's a sense, or at least there used to be when I started reading you, of waiting for McGuane to get the tail feathers moving. When is the McGuane style going to start making its signature moves? Mm. Do you feel that when you're writing?
Well, I do in some ways. I mean, I have some things that are part of sort of muscle memory when I'm writing, and I have to say that I try to suppress them, and I only let the ones through that won't be held back. I think, you know, I'm always trying to subdue my satirical impulses, or at least embed them so deep that their vibrations reach the surface from a great distance. But I think when I was a younger writer, it was easy to really let myself loose, especially when it comes to matters of language. And now I really am trying to make sure that it's pulling its weight in terms of the narrative itself and not just having fun. Nothing wrong with that. In fact, at some point before I mort out, I'd like to do one just for fun and just be as silly as I feel like being.
Oh, I wish, actually.
Really?
Oh, yeah, I do. I do, because, you know, I have all sorts of odd ideas about what formed you as a writer, because they started to track you down before there was internet to do the tracking for me. So I remember that there was, of all crazy things, a Feshrift for Juna Barnes.
Yes.
Well, she wrote a great novel called Nightwood.
Yes.
And you had a paragraph-long appreciation of her. And I thought, in fact, that Marlon Brando wearing a dress in Missouri Breaks was an acknowledgement of Dr. Matthew Mighty Grain of Salt O'Connor.
Oh, it could be.
In Nightwood, who went around a priest wearing dresses.
Right.
And but I felt that Juna Barnes writing, where everything was always alive, where there was no dead space between morbid and discarnate images.
Yeah, no, I know. And I mean, I remember being very moved by her work at one point in time. And I had, you know, I used to read Wiesemann and all those kind of really kind of corrupt people. I really liked them. I was probably under the influence of my friend Edmund White, who was my high school chum.
Really?
Oh, yeah, we're lifelong friends.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That makes so much sense, I can't say.
And I was a little hoodlum in high school, and he thought I was a pretty good writer. The faculty thought I was hopeless. And so a lot of my hopes for myself as a writer came from the fact that my brilliant friend thought I was pretty smart. But I also got his reading list all the time. And he was, you know, he was so bright, you know, as a young guy. You know, he'd read all of Proust by the time he was 13 or something.
But here in Crow Fair, there are two, maybe three, almost three, terrific con men.
Mm-hmm.
There's one in Motherlode.
Yeah.
There's one in The Good Samaritan.
Right.
And the woman who becomes president of a bank but who was once a prostitute.
Right.
She's almost a case.
Yeah.
That's
very smart of you. That's great. By the way, Motherlode just got picked for Best American Stories the last couple of days.
Oh, I'm happy to hear it. These stories move forward in such quick incremental spurts that you barely notice how funny he's being because he's moving it along so very, very quickly. How much rewriting does that New Yorker force you through, or does it arrive at their desks with that kind of speed?
No, a little of both. I mean, I'm a serious reviser. I mean, I draft and I draft and I draft. And a big thing that I'm doing is trying to get rid of things. And then what you just said kind of rings a bell with me, which is that anything that's especially comic that's kind of embedded in it, I like to be four beats down the road before the reader has sort of figured out what just happened to him. Then I have a wonderful editor at The New Yorker. I think there's seven or eight New Yorker stories here. But in a non-coercive way, you know, just raise questions, you know. And I love questions. And I'm someone who likes to talk, you know, or correspond about things that I'm thinking about doing, and I'm not remotely defensive about that. So I try to get it sort of bomb-proof by the time I deliver it. And then I like finding out ways in which I could be wrong about that. They have to be plausible, and I have to believe them, and I have to remind myself I'm the writer, I'm in charge of these choices, but I'm always happy to hear them.
I know that Terrence Malick is about to put out a film, maybe called The Night of Cups, about the horrors of Los Angeles and what it can do to a pure spirit. And most of your writing now takes place not in the coastal cities, but in Montana. Do you feel that there are places that are bad for writers to live?
No, I really don't feel that way at all. You know, I feel there are places and situations. There's no city that's as bad for writers as a laptop with wireless.
But you had a bad time in Los Angeles, I hear.
Well, it just was a poor fit for me. I mean, I came out here really because I wasn't surviving. You know, as a writer, I had to do something else. But it wasn't an industry that I was comfortable in. I mean, I did five movies here and so on. I did a lot when I was here, and I went back and forth, and I made friends here, and I liked it. But the idea of spending my life in the motion picture industry, it was a non-starter for me. It's not anything I wanted. I don't have any contempt for it, but I didn't want to do that.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from KCRW. I'm talking with Thomas McGuane about his book of stories, Crow Fair. We'll continue after this short break.
This is Connie Alvarez. Bookworm is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station in Los Angeles. It costs money to put this program together. Please help support us by going to kcrw.com/join.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Thomas McGuane about his recent book, Crow Fair, Stories of Families, Friendships, and Those Terrible Awkward Moments Between Them That Can Be As Funny As They Are Heartbreaking and Awful. I feel this is one of those questions that probably time should have taught me not to ask, but I feel like you've come back. Do you have any feeling of having been gone and coming back?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I think that, you know, I always knew from early on that really writing was all I really wanted. But lots of life kind of comes and goes and intervenes in various ways. But, you know, in at least the recent decade at least, I've really known this is what I do and what I want to do and happy to be able to do, or grateful would be a better word. And I also feel that I know how to do it more than I ever have before. So that's a great perception that you had there. I mean, you sort of fleshed me out of from under the chinaberry bush, and that's true. There is, but I must say I haven't had that thought before.
Well, I'm very glad, because you know there are stories in here where you don't recognize until the very last line what kind of dumbass the narrator is.
Mm.
I mean, there's a story here, admittedly short. It's called Casserole. He doesn't understand that he's driving his wife back to her parents, and she's going to stay there.
Yeah.
In fact, he doesn't even really get it until his wife's mother hands him a bucket and says, casserole. And he says, why? And she says, something to eat on your way home.
And it's funny reading this to audiences because he's such a ghastly human being. You know, they you can tell they think McGuane thinks there's something nice about this guy. You know, and I see worried looks around the room. Is this the hero?
And there's another story that I think is really terrific, not just terrifically structured, but terrifically funny as well. It's called On a Dirt Road. A wife wants to have dinner with a couple she knows the husband hates. She's going off to have her own special dinner with a boyfriend that the husband would hate still more, while he goes down the road to meet the new neighbors, who are both psychopaths. He's going to surprise them by going to the restaurant where the wife is supposed to be. She ain't there. And what's more, it takes a while at Rascal's Pizza because they have 91 toppings. And someone with a brain injury, as the wife of the new neighbors, has a brain injury. She's going to have a lot of trouble choosing the topping on the pizza. And then when he sees... When he sees that his wife is not there in the restaurant, he pretends to have gotten a message. His wife has hurt herself, hurt her ankle. How? Says the guest. Gopher hole. He gets back. His wife is not there, hasn't been there. She's coming home from her affair, and he's sitting there facing the door with a bowl of buttered popcorn, which he's eating in an accusatory fashion. And she says, taking up a kernel, well, do we just leave it here? You just go, holy moly, is that well structured and ultimately so humanly devastating.
Yeah, I know. How do you want to leave it? I thought you were going to land on the line, the toppings, damn it.
Well, just the name Rascals is enough.
I know.
Are you having the fun you used to have?
Oh, I'm having a lot of fun. I mean, actually having you summarize that story for me just then and remembering each of the little tropes as they arose, you know, in the kind of giddiness, you know, you feel with a discovery. I mean, that's lots of fun.
Because it's very interesting. The other narrators, the old ones, used to be ne'er-do-wells. Mm-hmm. And we expected them to bleep up.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, of course. There, you know, there's plenty of cocaine and plenty of stimulants for them.
Right.
These are people who are trying their best to leave that all behind, and it will overtake them anyway,
yeah,
because that's what life does to you. And so the stories feel more profound, richer.
Oh, good. Well, yeah, I mean, yes, I agree.
And yet you crack yourself up as you write.
Well, I can't get away from it. I mean, all my heroes were, you know, my enduring hero is Svevo, you know, and you know, the kind of deadpan thing that he does in Svevo, in Zeno. You know, when I went to Italy for a book fair, and my publicist over there was Svevo's granddaughter.
This is the great Italian writer, Italo Svevo, who for a time was a student of James Joyce,
right.
who admired his his comic novels.
And they are priceless.
Magnificent.
Yeah, yeah. They're just priceless. And Machado de Assis is another writer. Epitaph of his
poem. He is going to force me into explaining everything to you, listener, in the scene. Machado de Assis, a brilliant, ironic Brazilian writer, ironical, philosophical, about the hopelessness of human life.
Right. Well said. But, I mean, how can you not be changed once you find out about those people?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, yeah.
They change your mind about what's worth writing.
Molecularly, at the molecular level.
Yeah.
That happened to me. Or even on a more approachable, you know, Pickwick Papers. I mean, that...
Oh, my God. Well, that's one of my very favorite books. I mean... he attends a picnic with a Russian ambassador who keeps calling him Mr. Bigvig instead of Mr. Pickwick. And, of course,
don't
he is.
Don't get me going about Pickwick. It's the greatest.
Yes, it's unbelievable.
It is.
It's the only thing that needs to be said is that it is famous, or at least it was when I was 12, that a girl... who was 12 when the book The Pickwick Papers came out, Charles Dickens's first full-length novel, that she laughed herself to death. And that's what I wanted.
Yeah.
That's what I want from a book.
Sorry. Me too.
What a way to go.
What I longed for, I wanted to get the review that Dos Passos got for USA Today. He got a review. The review was very short. An explosion in a cesspool.
Tom, you better get busy.
I know. There's so much to do.
I've been talking with Thomas McGuane at long last. You know, never don't come here. Always come here. No, promise.
No,
we'll talk like real people who love books instead of like people who like Montana. You know, we'll do the real thing. We like Montana, but we also...
Yeah, I agree.
Decor. Paul, he's the author of Crow Fair. It's a book of stories. It's published by Knopf. Thank you, Tom, for joining me. This has been great.
I've enjoyed every speck of it.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Crow Fair at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to my assistant, David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Per Pedersen is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.